Did you see the stylish kids in the riot? Shoveled up like monks, set the night on fire, wombles bleed, truncheons and shields. You know I cherish you, my love. Welcome to the Young IPA Podcast. I'm James, this is Pete.
G'day everyone.
It is the 7th of December and this is episode 89. Huge show for you guys coming up. We've got the second part of our interview with Brendan O'Neill. This one's going to be getting into free speech and a few other different areas. Really interesting stuff. And we are also going to be talking to the IPA's newest research fellow, Dr. Zach Gorman. He is joining us from New South Wales. He's going to be working here on Western Civilization. And he's going to be writing a book about the Magna Carta. So we're going to talk to him about that. Really interesting stuff as well.
Really good interview.
Yes. So that's all coming up the show. We are also going to be hearing from a few of the IPA's campus coordinators who were down in Melbourne for the IPA's 75th anniversary event. We got them into the studio. We had them sort of talk about themselves and talk about the program. So you guys are going to be hearing from them throughout the show.
While they got involved in Liberty.
Yes, absolutely. So let's talk some of the stories, Pete. What do we want to start with?
Well, I want to talk about France because as regular listener Frank pointed out to me last week, Emmanuel Macron.
You're a man of the people.
I am a man of the people.
Yeah.
I am a man of the people. Lectured Trump on energy policies.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the elites of the world cheered him on and laughed at Trump. And, well, I would say that the joke's on him because France is going pear-shaped at the moment. I'm going to pronounce this incorrectly, but the protesters in France, as you'd all know, wearing the yellow jackets, are called...
Oh, here we go.
Gilets jaunes.
Sounds good to me.
Does anyone... I did French for a couple of years in high school. Anyway, you know what I'm talking about. The yellow jackets. So, obviously...
Depardieu. That's my French.
Okay, college boy.
Jean-Claude Van Damme. Not even a French guy.
That's
Belgian.
Yep.
These are just names.
Just names. All right. Really cross on. No, so there was... what happened? So the protests were about Macron's fuel tax increase to fight climate change. They've since merged into other areas such as, you know, healthcare and aged care and stuff for workers and stuff for workers. Yeah, things like that. So it's still growing. 89,000 police.
But definitely it's like still mainly about the fuel tax. That's what got people into the streets at the start.
That's right. And there's 89,000 people. 89,000 police are going to be deployed across France over the weekend. On Wednesday, of course, the people won. On Wednesday, Macron agreed to abandon the fuel tax. There's a couple of really important things about this. Firstly, this movement was completely grassroots. It bypassed the traditional left-wing establishment, if you will, trade unions, political parties. At the start, the media were calling them far-right protests in France, which they obviously weren't. And so this is a real grassroots movement. And secondly, it's a grassroots movement primarily against climate change policies.
Yeah. So when we talked to Brendan O'Neill later in the show today about the new, and sort of in the show last week when he talked about Brexit, the new divides in society and how left and right are falling apart, this is a working class movement
Absolutely.
Against a left-wing policy,
That's
which
exactly
is
right.
how to fight climate change. It's really interesting.
It's completely right. It was a leaderless, spontaneous movement. We should mention there has been four people have died and a lot of people have been injured. 85% of the public in France are uncomfortable with the violence, and of course the violence against property and people is obviously terrible, but a whopping 72% support the movement in general.
Yeah. It's just super interesting stuff. So there's going to be more protests this weekend. As Pete says, it's such a grassroots movement that the police can't even talk to anyone about where they're going to protest or anything. It's just a completely spontaneous one.
That's right. And over the last day or two, footage emerged of the police beating living daylights out of people in Burger King, which I'm sure
Oh, did you see someone had a body cam on and the fight around the Arc de Triomphe? That was one of the protests and the Arc de Triomphe got damaged a little.
Yeah.
But someone had a body cam on. It is wild. Yeah. I'm so glad I'm not a rioter. Like, there's no cause in the world that would get me to actually riot. Well, maybe there might be, but...
let's leave that for the next week.
It seems intense.
It is very... Well, the French protest a lot.
Yeah.
And you could argue that the French police don't deal with it very well.
Well, apparently so. That's really interesting. A protest that's probably not as big, Pete, sorry to throw you under the bus with a back-to-back topic, was the climate protests last week in Australia.
That's right. So another set of protests, and one of the great things about these protests was that they involved a walkout, which, as you know, I'm all about a walkout.
Yep.
And the walkouts, as we'll talk about later in the show, continued. Last Friday, thousands of kids around Australia walked out to ask for action on climate change.
Yep.
As if the government's
That's why they walked out.
Yeah.
That's definitely why they walked out.
I don't understand why. Couldn't you just be like, we're already stymieing the economy, we're ruining electricity prices.
Yeah, as Dan says, no other country is working harder to keep up to its Paris agreements than Australia.
Old people won't turn their air conditioning on because it costs too much. Anyway, so lots of walkouts. Where am I up to with this? So obviously the left hailed them as historic and brave and all that stuff. And that's probably the most annoying thing about them. ScoMo said students should be... Oh, the Prime Minister said students should be less activist. I agree with them. I want action on climate change too. I think we should build 10 nuclear reactors to massively slash... What did I say? Did I say nuclear?
Yep.
10 nuclear reactors, yep. Because that's an important point. To massively slash emissions and decrease the price of electricity.
Yeah. My thing with this is, if you have a political point that you want to make... find a 7-year-old to repeat it, and suddenly that gives it more weight. I don't know what it is, but if you get like someone under the age of 14 to make your political point, it makes you seem smarter.
It's a powerful tool.
Reverse way of how we've done it for a while, but now it's like the second a 7-year-old says it, like, look, this is a brave stand, and we need to think about future generations.
Apparently there's a girl in Holland that's been on strike for 12 weeks over climate change.
I think she's just not going back to school.
She's one smart cookie. She
Yeah, and then you had like the 15-year-old giving a speech about climate policy at the UN. So this is the thing.
Well, I don't have a problem with children protesting per se. Yep. In history, you know, in South Africa, there were student protests which changed South Africa forever during the apartheid era.
Yeah, this isn't the apartheid era.
I'm fully cognizant of that, but my only problem with these children is that they're wrong.
Yeah, that's fair enough. Well, my problem is that there are teachers and parents that are using them to push their own political agenda forward, and they should be at school.
Yeah,
that is my point. Yeah. I mean, if they genuinely care about the environment and they want to protest, you know, that's open debate. Like, go out. But
they are
being used as props. That is the thing that is definitely happening. If you do want to hear more about it, so the IPA's Dr. Bella De Brera, great friend of the show. She had an article in the Daily Telegraph on this issue that is available at the IPA website. So you can go check that out.
Can I just make one more point about this? Is there anything 2018, anything more 2018 than the smug, witty, oppressively middle-class protest banner?
No. I was going to say pumpkin spice lattes, but no, you're right. Yeah.
It's... Anyway.
Absolutely. All right. Another one. This should be getting protests, but it isn't at the moment. So, new national security laws are being brought in. Pete and I are not tech heads. I've only just found out about Facebook.
I don't get it.
It seems interesting.
I didn't realize people were listening to this.
Yeah. Pete and I have just been meeting in a room for over a year.
Sounding off.
And somehow people come up to us at events and say they've been listening. And we don't quite know why. Nina says she knows why. We don't believe her. But anyway, so new national security laws are giving authorities the power to intercept encrypted communications. So these are laws that are likely to pass Parliament by the end of the week. There's a few IT firms and global tech giants who are saying this isn't a very good idea because of the, you know, that little thing called individual privacy and liberty.
Yeah, I mean, they don't care about that.
Yeah, but they want to keep that.
They want the money.
No, yeah, you should pay us for that data, not just have it. But anyway, the police are about to have a whole lot more power as to what they can look at on your phone. And it's being slammed by critics for being broad in scope, vague, and potentially damaging to the security of the global digital economy. Again, this is stuff that happens every time the government's like, oh, we need more more laws to look into people's phones.
Cost security.
Because terrorism. And it's always broad in scope, and it's always vague, and it's never well thought out.
And there is no way any of them, or not any of them, there's no way all of them understand it.
Yeah. Oh.
What's in the bill? Well, terrorism.
So, I'm sold.
Yeah.
Here's all the money. Anyway, so the most terrifying part of the bill gives the powers to police to force you to open your smartphone for them.
Really?
Yeah.
I did not know that.
That is bad.
That is bad.
Like, you know, you need a warrant to enter someone's house, but the police can just say, open your smartphone for us.
That's right.
It's also going to go after companies to give them access to data. And this is something that Dr. Chris Berg, adjunct fellow here at the IPA, he's been talking about data security for a while. And the thing that always it comes back to always is that it's not the original people that ask for the data that end up going to get it. So they talk about, like, look, it's only going to be counterterrorism. It's only going to be counterterrorism. Then the ATO says then they need it. Yeah. And these other organizations, like I think health records are starting to go out to other places. It's like you are giving every government department the ability to ask for that data when you say to the first guy, you can have this data.
Yeah, and that's
what
quietly.
Gets really scary.
That like, people don't realize that 10 years down the track, it's, you know, all these bodies are suddenly having a crack at it.
Oh, and then you got stuff. Remember the Edward Snowden leaks from the NSA? There's just, you know, individual people are just spying on their ex-girlfriend, seeing what they are up to. So you're also giving everyone who works at that department access to your data in case they just don't like you.
That's right.
So it's the creepiest thing in the world when you really sit back and think about all the things that the government can know about you. And yeah,
but
that would be a whole lot more.
One reason why you don't have to worry, James, is that the government only utilizes
these. I'm not interesting.
The first, that's point A. Point B is the government will only utilise these laws if reasonable and proportionate.
Oh, good. Okay, cool.
So,
all right, don't worry about it.
No government anywhere.
Nina,
if
you just want to edit off the show and then we'll just start again and we'll just drop this as a thing because it's just, it's, you know.
They're only going to be reasonable and proportionate, so there's nothing to worry about.
Yeah. Cool. All right. So, last one we'll talk about and then we'll go to our interview. So, this was an interesting, this probably could go down the bottom, but it is fun. So, Stanford University, they are trying to out, they're trying to get rid of this one fraternity called Sigma Chi.
Not cheap.
Leave it to. I don't know what the French pronunciation is, Pete. So I'll leave it to people out there to think of. But anyway, so we've all seen frat movies. We know what they're about. It's a bit, there's now the anti-frat movement happening in America, where they're trying to just
Is it?
Yeah. They're just trying to say like it's not the culture that we want to put forward. So anyway, this one place, Sigma Chi, in Stanford. They are on the way out, and so they sit down with the university administrator, and they're asking, like, oh, how can we get back? Because, you know, we want to stay here. We want to keep the fraternity going. It's been going for a while. How do we get back in the university's good graces? And the article doesn't talk about it. They just say Mr. Zed is the university administrator. He's giving a few reasons.
Gave him a fake name.
It's like, really, Mr. Zed? That's your name? Anyway, so he said, Mr. Zed urged Sigma Chi, this coming out from the Stanford student newspaper, Mr. Zed urged Sigma Chi to consider the image being presented to the rest of the campus by flying the American flag out front. He further that if the fraternity wished to break away from the stereotypes that plagued the house and to change its perception on campus, its members should contemplate unhoisting the American flag. Mr. Zed's tone further signaled to the fraternity that he found the mere sight of the American flag to be offensive. So what they did, which is very good and how you respond to these things, is they did take down the American flag and replaced it with an even bigger American flag.
Correct.
Which is very well done.
That's right.
It's like the Trump, you know, the wall just got 10 feet higher. The flag just got 10 times bigger, mate.
Yeah.
No. Yeah, so if, like the university's come out and they've said, this isn't the university policy. You should be able to fly flags. If this was said, then it's not the reflection of the university standards, which I think is interesting because they didn't say it wasn't said. They just said, well, might have been said.
Yeah. It's probably true that Stanford don't have an official policy against American flags, but it's also probably true that a massive proportion of the people that work at Stanford hate America.
Yeah, absolutely. Like, this is a cultural cringe. Like, a friend of a friend got permanent residency in Australia, and so her friends wanted to throw a party for her, and they put up an Australian flag in a bar in Collingwood.
Yeah.
They put up an Australian flag to say, you know, welcome to Australia. They were asked to take it down.
You're kidding.
Yeah.
Okay, was it, what, for why?
Just like, we don't want the Australian flag up there.
Really?
Like, Collingwood. Collingwood.
In the bar.
In the bar. They were just like, can you please take down the Australian flag?
Yeah. Well,
so yeah. Well, it's, I mean, it's cultural cringe. It's just not great.
There's people that work in any university in the West that would hate the country that they're
in.
Good point.
That's true. The other one I had was like, this story ends. So this story should end with the Mr. Zed going back and saying, nice joke, guys, but seriously. Yeah. And then he comes back the next day and the entire fraternity house is just the American flag.
Mm.
Like, just the entire thing.
If this were a sitcom written by you, that's what
and
would
happen. And then Mr. Zed
happened.
Goes back to his home and that's the American flag. That might be illegal. But funny.
Yeah.
Anyway, so last week was the IPA 75th anniversary dinner. Pete and I and Nina, we heroically recorded a show the day after. No need to thank us. But if you weren't there and you did want to hear some of the speeches that were said, so we had Brendan O'Neill, Janet Ulbrechtsen, and we also played a really nice video that Nina talked about, brought a tear to her eye. Now, the reason I bring all this
she's got a heart of stone.
She does.
So
a dark tyrant. Anyway, so if you wanted to watch those videos, if you want to listen to those speeches, they are all up on the IPA's YouTube channel. So head on over there and you can watch it. You can watch the video that made Nina cry. You can watch Janet's speech and you can watch Brendan's speech as well. We also have two episodes of the Great Books of Literature podcast have just come out. Double episode. We're going to be John and Andrew Bolt are talking about The Radetzky March by Joseph Roth and Pride and Prejudice by Jane Austen. John, not a fan of Pride and Prejudice. Jane Austen.
Can you give us a teaser on why he doesn't like it?
Sorry. I guess people will have to listen. That's the teaser. The teaser is he doesn't like it. Why?
Okay. Yeah,
what does Andrew think of John not liking it? Guess he'll have to listen to the show.
Okay.
All right. And then we also.
Fair enough.
Yeah, it is fair enough. So we also had. As I said before, Dr. Bella De Brera, Daily Telegraph. She is talking about the children's climate protest. That's available on ipa.org.au, as is Evan Mulholland, our media guy, talking about Turnbull and the way he's conducting himself now that he's out as leader. That's also on the IPA website. Cool. So that's it for what the IPA has done this week. We'll now go to our interviews with Brendan O'Neill, Zach Gorman, and you'll have the chance to listen to our campus coordinators. But before we do, everyone out there, thank you so much for listening to the show. Thank you so much for subscribing. We're available on iTunes and Spotify and any podcast app that you use. You can find the IPA podcast, download it. Yep, that is the service we use. But any podcast app out there, you can use us, as you know, but your friends and family might not. So make sure, we're coming up to Christmas season. You're going to be spending a lot of time with friends and family. Bring up the show. Always a good way to start off the Christmas is to start talking about politics. So yeah, bring up the show, tell them to listen, and you can subscribe for free.
Tell your lefty uncle to listen.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, that'd be great. And if you are listening on iTunes, again, it is Christmas season, this time of giving. So give us a 5-star review for Christmas. We'd really appreciate it. Nina, if people want to become an IPA member this year, maybe they want to buy an IPA membership for someone for Christmas, maybe they want to donate to the IPA's Christmas appeal, they might want to do any number of those things, how can they do it?
Well, just visit our website, ipa.org.au, and to buy someone's an IPA membership, just click on the join button, and starting as low as $22, you and the person that you're going to give up is going to become one of the loudest voices of freedom in Australia.
How good was Nina's energy in that?
Yeah, Nina was
absolutely
pumped.
I'm happy. Really, I'm actually excited for Christmas.
Oh, yeah? Seem like a very big Christmas person.
I am a very big Christmas person, actually. I listen to his Christmas songs from October. June, if you could. Yeah, sometimes I feel like, oh, I want a Christmas.
Number one Christmas song.
I'll Be Home for Christmas.
Oh, that's not bad.
Yeah, I always love that song.
All right, very cool. All right, let's go to those interviews now.
Hi, my name is Olivia Masso. I'm the campus coordinator at the University of Notre Dame Fremantle in Western Australia. And I think the best thing about being a campus coordinator is being able to be a voice for students who possibly have some alternative or minority beliefs, but they feel like they can't be expressed because of their professors or because of their peers. So we kind of have an outlet for people to go where they know that they're not going to be alone on campus and actually be normal and make friends who aren't crazy people on campus. No offense. But
so you've described yourself in the past as a free speech absolutist. Do you want to unpack what that means? Like, where do you stand on freedom of speech?
It means that no speech should ever be banned or censored or punished, including libelous speech, including incitement to hatred. I'm a free speech absolutist, and I think freedom, being in favor of freedom of speech, necessarily means being a free speech absolutist, because as soon as you caveat it or say, yes, free speech is great, but not for these points of view over here, or not for that kind of speech over there, then you're no longer arguing for freedom of speech. You're arguing for privileged speech. You're arguing for the right of certain people to speak and the right of other people, but not the right of other people to speak. So free speech absolutist means I support all forms of freedom of speech with no restrictions at all.
So we saw recently in Britain this FOI request for information about hate speech reports to police in 2015 and 2016. There were 2,500 reports, and this is like this wave of xenophobia that's meant to be sweeping Britain in and around Brexit.
Yeah.
What was your favourite one out of those? Because there were so many humorous ones in there.
We had a dog pooping on someone's lawn.
Yes, racist dog.
Racism. We had disputed line calls in a tennis match was racism. Any others jumping out at you, Pete?
The car horn.
Did you
hear that one? Yeah, the car. That's my favourite one, where this elderly white woman was beeping her horn at a car in front of her, which happened to be driven by a black woman, which she didn't know because she couldn't see the driver. And it was reported as a hate incident. It was reported as a racist beeping of the car horn, and the police have now registered that as a hate incident. So when you see the statistics in Britain for this year, whatever it might be, I don't know, 30,000 hate incidents, you have to bear in mind that one of them was a little old white lady beeping her horn because she was angry at a driver. It's ridiculous and bizarre and Kafkaesque, but it's really interesting because it shows how utterly subjective the idea of hate crime and hate speech is now. Because if you look at the police, the British police's definition of hate crime is actually quite terrifying, because they define a hate crime as a crime that is perceived to be hateful either by the victim or any other person.
Yeah.
And what's more, they go on to stipulate that there doesn't need to be proof of the hateful component, and the police should avoid insisting upon proof because it could make the victim feel even worse than they already feel. So, for example, so if you're a trans woman, say, and someone burns down your shed, and you go to the police and say, oh, my shed was burnt down. So they say, right, that's a crime. And then you say, oh, and I believe it was transphobic. And they will say, right. And that is instantly recorded as a transphobic hate crime with no evidence, no questions, nothing. So it's entirely subjective. And I find, you know, that the British left has entirely bought into this. And the one thing that the British left used to do quite well in the 1970s and 80s, they used to be quite good at deconstructing crime panics. So they're quite good at looking at how certain constituencies in society were kind of labeled as evil, and all this kind of crime statistics were built around them. So football hooligans is the classic example. They were a big crime panic in the 1970s. Black muggers were a big crime panic in the 1980s. Teddy boys were a huge crime panic in the 1950s. The mods versus the rockers, that's one of the classic crime panics of the 1960s. And the left was very good at doing really good analysis of how these stories were basically invented and how statistics were made up to suit the narrative that already existed. But they cannot see that the exact same thing is being done in relation to hate speech and hate crime, particularly post-Brexit. They cannot see we are living through the politicized construction of a crime panic and a moral panic. And instead, they are entirely pushing that line. So it's really scary, because what it basically means is that there's almost nothing you can do or say in Britain right now without running the risk that someone somewhere will call it a hate crime and it will then be registered as such.
Yeah, because that's the point, because you bring up the analogy of someone burning down a shed, but to bring it to the little old lady, there's nothing illegal about honking your horn at someone.
Yes,
and
that's right.
If people are starting to govern honking horns or just anything untoward, you know, not a crime, but if someone can perceive it as a hate incident, everyone's just going to be self-policing themselves from now on.
That's right. But you know, the bigger principle I think here is that even if you do burn down someone's shed for transphobic reasons, I still think you shouldn't be punished for that. You should be punished for burning down the shed.
Yeah,
that's an attack on someone's property, and you're not allowed to do that. But you shouldn't be given extra punishment because you did it with transphobic intent. And this is where we really get into thought policing territory. So in Britain, and this goes for other Western countries too, if you punch a man in the face, you can be taken to court and fined, or maybe even given a jail sentence. If you punch a man in the face because you don't like Hindus, you will be given extra punishment. You will be given a longer sentence. You will be given a higher fine. I have a real problem with that, because then what the state is doing is not only judging you, not only punishing you for your behavior, which the state must sometimes do, but also punishing you for your point of view, punishing you for your thoughts, punishing you for what's inside your head. So I have a problem with every single aspect of this. I have a problem with the police recording the honking of a horn as a hate incident, even though it's not a crime. I also have a problem with them recording hate crimes full stop. My view is that you just record and investigate crimes. The question of the ideological motive is one that we really need to be careful before we bring that as a factor into the investigation and certainly into the punishment.
And another one, sorry, but another part of that there is also the state saying that these are different groups of people, like saying that in law, Hindus are different to other people.
Yeah.
Which is not the way, like, not the experience where we should be.
It's a very divisive.
It's not a good idea.
Yeah.
I think the tragedy for me is that, like, actually in Britain, hate crimes are going down. I think a separate survey which records actual hate crimes said they were down by 40%, which is a good thing, and people should be hearing that message.
Yeah.
And the other thing is that it obscures actual racist and terrible events when they do happen, because so many people are used to going, oh no, that's not true, because, you know, because of these frivolous incidences.
It's so clear to anyone who's lived in Britain for a few decades that it's a less racist country than it was. Yeah. It's so obvious. I mean, I am old enough to remember in the 80s and the 90s when you would see racism regularly. You would hear it regularly. People would make comments that you just don't hear anymore. People at football matches would throw bananas at black players. I mean, that was a regular occurrence at British football matches in the 1980s. That doesn't happen anymore. So There has been a radical turn away from the racist outlook. But the bizarre thing about the liberal elite and the political class and all the rest of them is that the less racism there is in Britain, the more they see it everywhere. They see it in every tweet. They see it in every piece of culture. They see it in every, fancy dress costume on campus. Fancy dress parties are often banned for being racist. They see it in the honking of a car horn. They see racism everywhere. And so I think what we have is a situation where this so-called anti-racism is really just a form of misanthropy. This view that people are pretty awful and dreadful and they must be racist because they're such awful people. I mean, that's really the sentiment behind it. There's no positive component to this anti-racism at all, whereas there was a hugely positive component to the anti-racist movements of the 1950s and 60s and also the 1980s. So I'm interested in the way in which accusations of racism or this kind of desire to discover racism everywhere really speaks to a political elite which is just so removed from ordinary people that it doesn't know that in fact the vast majority of them are not racist.
Yeah, and to bring it back to the wokeness that we were discussing at the start of the interview, it's like if I call out even this, thing that isn't racist, but if I call it out as racist, then everyone can see me that I'm not racist, even though you're the one that the only person recognizing it as racist.
It's bizarre, and it's I've been called when I speak on campuses sometimes there's protests and so on and people hold up placards saying get this racist off campus, and they have nothing. And so I cornered one of these people once and said, what do you mean? And he said, well, you wrote a piece recently saying Martin Luther King was right and we shouldn't judge people by their skin color. And so that's now held up as a form of racism apparently it denies people's racial and cultural experiences if you just say, I think all people are the same.
So that means he was a racist.
So Martin Luther King, by today's standards, would unquestionably have been a racist. He would not have been woke. He would have been a racist.
Absolutely. That's crazy. Another thing that's happening in Britain with, you mentioned seeing racism in all these tweets. Pete and I doing this podcast, we see a lot of different police departments in the UK bragging about how many people have got scrolling online looking for hate incidents, as if this should be a point of pride for a police department to have a great online patrolling. Where does that come from?
Yeah, our police have become incredibly Orwellian.
Yeah,
I mean, it's just nuts. They patrol Twitter all the time. I mean, they put up tweets saying, watch what you tweet, we're watching you. I mean, it's straight out of 1984. It's terrifying. And it's, it's reached really strange scenarios where, for example, this teenage boy a few years ago wrote a joke on Twitter about Tom Daley, the diver, some joke about Tom Daley's dad who died, some very crass joke. And the police went to his house
and told
him to stop making crass jokes. And then around the same time, there was this disaster in Glasgow a few years ago where a lorry ran out of control on a shopping street just before Christmas and killed, I think, 6 or 7 people. And someone made a joke about it online. In the way that people sometimes do make crass jokes about tragedies. And the police went to his house and told him to stop making crass jokes. I mean, that's incredibly sinister. That really is the stuff of a tyrannical state when the police are telling you what kind of jokes you're allowed to make. And of course, there's the infamous case of Count Dankula, who taught his girlfriend's pug to do a Nazi salute. And he was arrested, found guilty of being grossly offensive, because it can potentially be a crime to be grossly offensive in Britain. And he was fined £800. So he's got a criminal conviction for making a YouTube skit. I mean, this is where we're at right now. The police are out of control. But what's really interesting is over the past few weeks, some leading police chiefs have started to push back and have started to make statements saying, we can't spend all our time investigating wolf whistles or misogynistic tweets or people who are just make racist and idiotic comments, because firstly, that's not our job, or it shouldn't be. And secondly, because, there are some serious crime epidemics in Britain, particularly the knife crime epidemic in London, which is claiming a huge number of young lives. So a lot of ordinary people are watching the police tweet saying, don't do a bad tweet or we'll come and arrest you, and thinking to themselves, why aren't you doing something about the stabbing to death of huge numbers of youngsters in London? So I think a turn might be coming. I hope so, because at the moment the police are behaving like Orwellian dictators.
So this is another source of optimism for you.
Yes, it is. So I think...
racking them up.
Yeah. Pete's got a personal theme of this interview.
Making a list of my optimistic... Yeah, I think so. It's more that... I guess my main point of optimism is that I think there's such a huge divide now between how the political class approaches issues and how ordinary people approach them. I think that's one of the most fruitful divides right now.
Mm. So... What? Just before you came to Australia, we had an election here in Victoria. We had the Liberal Party absolutely destroyed at the polls. It just like they were going to be close for a lot of the while, and then just at the end, it completely fell away. And there's all this speculation as to the divides. Can the Liberal Party cater to both Conservatives and Liberals? And to be honest, would it be fair to say that there's a similar thing happening with the UK Conservative Party where they can't really cater to Conservatives and Liberals and maybe people in the centre as well? Is there something about being on the right in 2018 that, you know, all of these different parties in all these different parts of the world are having trouble coming to terms with?
Yes, I think there is. I think I just think politics is unravelling in a really interesting way. I think there are a lot of political parties in the Western world which should probably split, and it would be more interesting. It would make political life more interesting if they did. So if you look at the Conservative Party in Britain, I mean, it looks like a divide over Brexit. So there are some Brexiteers and there are some and there are more Remainers. But actually, it just points to deeper divides over conservatism versus liberalism, social traditionalism versus a kind of more supposedly progressive view. The Conservative Party has been ripped apart by those divisions. So in my mind, it would make perfect sense if the Conservative Party split into two parties. You could have a Conservative Party and you could have a capital L Liberal Party. That would make a lot of sense in the UK at the moment. But it's not just the right. The same goes for the Labour Party, where suddenly in Britain, where there are huge divisions in the Labour Party between the Corbynistas on one side, who are these kind of crass 1970s-style state socialists who have never had an original idea and are, in fact, are very anti-intellectual and quite uncouth, in my view. And then the other side, which is often referred to as the Blairites, but that's kind of a derogatory term. They're really just kind of... more soft left or centrist left, who absolutely despise the Corbynistas, and the Corbynistas despise them. And it doesn't make any sense to me that they should be in the same party. So I think even in Labour, there should be a split. There should be a split between Corbyn's Labour Party and the so-called Blairite Labour Party. And I think that's happening across Europe as well. If you look at the tensions that exist in social democratic parties in particular, also in right-wing parties, I think there's a big argument to be made for these parties to separate themselves off into new entities and then seeing what happens as a result of that. I think it would make politics more honest and more interesting.
Yeah, very cool. So I was listening to your own podcast the other day, so the Brendan O'Neill Show, available through Spiked. You can give it a plug if you want.
Yes, it's brilliant. Listen to it.
Yeah, so it is brilliant. And you had an interview with... I'm sold. So you had an interview with Jonathan Haidt, the American psychiatrist or psychologist or...
Psychologist,
yeah. So my mum's going to kill me for that one because
it's a difference.
One of those things. So Jonathan Haidt, you were telling a story about a time that you were speaking on a campus and the issue of rape culture came up in the crowd and someone just had a complete meltdown. Mm. You saw your own triggering. Do you want to tell that story again? Because I thought it was so fascinating.
Yes, the first time I've ever witnessed an actual triggering. I mean, I've heard people say, you triggered me or I feel triggered, and I'd never really known what they meant, except I just thought they meant they were offended. And then I was doing this talk at Oxford University earlier this year, and a young woman asked me a question about rape culture. What do I think about rape culture? And I said, I have a real problem with the term rape culture, because I think it conflates a crime, rape, with a non-crime, culture. And it acts as an invitation to censorship, because if we say magazines and books and songs can cause rape, then we're really calling for censorship. And as I was saying this, she started to hyperventilate and she started to wheeze very noisily and quite violently to the extent that she couldn't control herself. And she had to be helped out of the room by two other people. And what was most shocking for me watching this, it was like almost like a kind of... as if she was possessed. It was like it was almost Salem-like, you know, that kind of in the grip of hysteria and kind of almost a performance of hysteria, but also a real thing at the same time. But what was most shocking to me is that the other students in the room didn't seem particularly put out by what was happening, and they were very relaxed. And most of them kept looking at me for me to carry on talking while I was thinking, this woman is dying over here. And so I said to them, what happened there? And they said, oh, you triggered her with your comment. So it made me think, actually, something quite worrying, and this is not optimistic, but it made me think that we have nurtured a new generation who genuinely do experience words as harmful and who genuinely do feel that ideas they disagree with can hurt them. So that's one of the things I was talking to Jonathan Hyde about on my podcast, just the way in which this kind of cotton wool parenting and this obsessive myopic protection of young people from any form of harm or bad experiences, or and you know, refusing to let them play outside or refusing to let them get into fights, is actually really bad for them, because then they grow up being super fragile and thinking that all sorts of things will have a terribly detrimental impact on their self-esteem. So I'm worried. The one thing I am very worried about is the way in which new parenting styles and new educational styles are nurturing a new generation which just doesn't have the raw materials of adulthood. And I think that's one of the great challenges we face, the question of how to turn that around and create a new generation of robust adults.
Yeah, exactly. Because that particular student might just be prone to panic attacks, yeah. But the idea that your view on rape culture hadn't even come across these students, and they had no idea how to come back with a disagreement to something they hear, that's so indicative of failure of the education system.
But you know, the thing is, for people who believe in liberty, I think sometimes we forget, or some of us forget, that you can't have liberty without the strong-willed individual. It's a point John Stuart Mill makes, which is that, you know, you need to trust in people's mental and moral capacity and their ability to see all things and hear all things and make up their minds for themselves as to whether they are interesting or not interesting. You need to encourage and cultivate robust individualism, daring individualism, strong individuals, in order for liberty to be a real thing. If you create all these weaklings and wimps who fall apart at the first sign of disagreement and who get to the age of 18 without ever getting slapped in the face in the playground, and who never have a Saturday job, and who've never had to struggle or stand up for themselves, then not only is society in trouble, but freedom is in trouble, because these people will say, well, we don't need freedom and we also don't want it because it's too scary. So I think that's one of the great challenges that liberals and libertarians face now, is how to reverse that culture of fragility in order to defend the robustness that freedom requires.
How do you think we would start doing that?
I think, well, I was asked that question at Eton. I did a speech at Eton, which is a super posh school.
That's where I'm at.
And I said, the first thing that came to my mind, which I kind of said just to be provocative, but then I later decided that it's actually true, is that firstly, we have to get rid of anti-bullying initiatives in schools. Yeah. And I'm not being facetious, I really mean that, because I think that's a very good example of how all these new therapeutic measures and buffer zones have been created to protect children from any kind of bad experience. Now, I'm not saying I'm in favor of children being bullied. Yeah. But when you redefine bullying so broadly so that it can mean anything from just being given a dirty look or being told or being shouted at in the playground or whatever.
Being honked out in a car.
In a car or anything, then you are basically just protecting children from life. You're protecting children from life itself, which has a lots of ups and lots of downs. So I think we need to create a situation where the young are allowed to experiment, to take risks, to go outside. You know, people often say kids today aren't allowed out. When I was young, we weren't allowed in. We were, you know, there were six boys in my family. And in the summer holidays, we were literally thrown out of the house at 9 o'clock in the morning and we weren't allowed back in. If we went back to our house, my mum would go mental because she had work to do. She didn't want us around the house. So that turnaround in the space of a generation is quite shocking. So I think we should encourage the young to take more risks, encourage them to be robust and aware, encourage them to reject wokeness, which is really just a kind of advertisement of your weakness and fragility and awareness and everything else, and just allow them to run a bit more freely. And I think if we do that, We will then create a new generation of adults who are willing to take responsibility for their own lives and responsibility for society. At the moment, we're not doing that.
Oh, I'm sorry, how did you get an invite to Eton? How did that come about? Is that like the students or the...
It was...
Pete's trying to get invited himself.
So. I've been invited a few times, once by students and the other times by teachers.
Really?
I'll put in a good word for you.
I thought that... just be massive lefties and dislike.
Some of them are. Okay. Yeah, some of them are. But then there are others at Eton who want to hold on to a few of the good old traditions.
Okay. So, our private schools are like definitely massively left-wing.
That's happening. But, you know, in relation to... I'm not entirely pessimistic about young people. I should make that clear. There are a huge number... on the flip side of all this kind of millennial fragility, which we focus on because we're worried about it. But on the flip side is there are lots of young people who just reject all that stuff. I think there's a strong class element to that. So when I speak on campuses in Britain, it's usually the really prestigious universities where this millennial wokeness is most pronounced. Mm-hmm. And then at the red brick universities, which is what we refer to universities from the 1960s, which tend to have more working class students, there's none of this. There is none at all.
Yeah.
They do not know platform people. They do not ban magazines. They do not ban me from speaking. So I think there's a very interesting class component. I think there's a very interesting geographical component. But I think alongside the fragile millennials who have a nervous breakdown if you talk about rape culture, there are a huge number of young people who find that demeaning and want to take control of their lives. And, you know, you have groups like Generation Liberty with you guys. I've seen movements on campuses in the UK where young people are standing up for freedom of speech and inviting controversial speakers. I've seen the same thing in the United States. So one of the most, I think, most fruitful things about today is that there is a pushback against millennial fragility from other millennials. And that, again, is another interesting divide, which is not left or right, but is actually much more important than that.
Yeah, and you also see the newfound celebrity fame of speakers like Jordan Peterson, Ben Shapiro, Dave Rubin as well. I mean, these are all coming from young people. And the idea of like a YouTube celebrity just saying, you know, classical liberal or conservative positions, that wasn't really a thing a few years ago. Now it definitely is a huge thing and it's going to get bigger.
That's right. I think, and all that's to the good. I have my disagreements with these people. I'm not convinced by all of their arguments, but I think the fact that they have this huge following among the young suggests that people are crying out, including supposedly weak millennials, are actually crying out for something else. I think they have to turn to these YouTube personalities and these YouTube people because it doesn't exist in mainstream society, doesn't exist in their educational institutions, it doesn't exist in mainstream public life. So I think the success of those individuals you're talking about is precisely an indication that the young cannot get that stuff from the mainstream, you know. And that's very simple stuff, you know. Take responsibility for your life, don't be an asshole, be a good person, be free-willed, you know, be personally accountable. So those are positive messages. And it's true what you say that they have. When I did the day, I was on the Dave Rubin show last year, and the number of young people who will then email you or contact you or say, "Oh, I was really interested in this point," or "Can you come to my campus and talk about that point?" It has this really positive knock-on effect, and it reminds you of that thing I am optimistic about, which is that, you know, behind all the headlines about rising levels of stress among the young and they can't cope with life and so on and so forth, there are huge numbers of young people out there who reject that narrative and want to have the thing that earlier generations of adults wanted too, which is to be free.
Yeah. So Pete and I are huge fans of Spiked, the website that you run. Now, one thing we've noticed recently is that Spiked is getting into the podcast game. I've seen you've got your own show. There's a few others as well. So what was the decision there?
People have been pushing me to let them do podcasts for a long time. I'm really old-fashioned on publishing front. I just want to write all the time. So we have, but I have some younger members of staff who would kind of put pressure on me to make sure that Spike did more audio, more video. So that's what we've been doing. And it's been going really well. So we have three podcasts. We have the weekly Spike podcast, which is run by Tom Slater, my deputy editor, and Fraser Myers. And that is really just a podcast to talk about the events and what's going on. And they do a fantastic job. Then we have mine, the Brendan O'Neill Show, which is a monthly podcast, but I want to make it more regular than that at some
Starting
point.
Starting slow.
Yeah. Starting slow. People have been emailing me saying, a monthly podcast? Are you joking? So I need to do something about that. And then we have a podcast called Last Orders, with Chris Snowden, who's a very interesting anti-nanny state writer and person in the UK, where we talk about nanny state issues and freedom issues and the right of people just to be left alone. So those are the three podcasts we do, and they're working really well. And you reach entirely new audiences, because what you realise, what I have now realised, which other people realised years ago, is that the podcast game is incredibly important, and a lot of people engage with ideas through podcasts, through listening to things as they walk to work, rather than through sitting down and reading stuff. So I think that new audience is quite exciting.
Yeah, that sort of leads into the next question I had, which was like the ability of podcasts to talk about things in a different way than writing in an op-ed. So are there certain issues that you think you'd rather talk about on a podcast than write, or are you just 100% I'd rather write anything?
No, I'm now getting more into podcasting. I think that's... I see them as quite similar, although I know there are important differences. I think the thing with writing is that it's very controlled. You only have a certain amount of space. You only have a certain number of words. You have to be incredibly focused. You can't kind of go off on a tangent, or you shouldn't if you're a good writer. You can't go off on a tangent and start thinking about something else. So it's a very tight space, and you want to keep people's attention for a short period of time. So you have to make your point well and make it quickly. Podcasts allow a bit more openness, a bit more freedom, it's a bit more conversational. Mm-hmm. People listen to really long podcasts.
I didn't realize.
2 hour long.
Yeah,
podcast.
I've become a huge Joe Rogan fan recently.
Really? Are they long podcasts?
3.5 hours.
Right.
It does like 3 a week.
Yeah.
But you can listen to them double pace as well. A lot of people do that.
What does that mean? Oh, so you speed it up?
Yeah, yeah. So it's like twice as fast.
That's
terrible. I don't love doing
people listen to this like. You know, blah, blah, blah,
so
blah, blah.
We're really squeaky and high pitched.
Yeah.
As they're
yeah, that's why I don't do it. It just ruins the timing, the flow. But yeah. So you've got a podcast now. We've got a podcast. Does that make us rivals?
Yeah. What's going on here?
Yeah, it does a little bit.
Right, nah, let's go. We can grow the pie.
Grow the pie together. Cool. All right. So one thing that we've noticed doing this podcast is that more and more, and this is something we've been talking about on and off through the interview, but we've noticed that more and more academics we've talked to, young people we've talked to, ordinary people, they're rebelling against PC culture. And we saw an article in Spikes recently, which was talking about how, I think it was at the time of the Edinburgh Fringe Festival, how many comedians are now starting to turn their back on the idea of political correctness. Do you get the sense that the tide has turned, or is it turning? What do you sort of make of it all?
I think it's turning. I think it's something's happening. And I think that's really interesting. I think people now realize that that's not a sustainable way of life, just to constantly check yourself and self-edit all the time and self-censor, even worse. They just realize that's not an honest approach to life. And it's particularly bad for comedians, because the whole point of comedy is that you're supposed to make people... you're supposed to shock people or surprise people or make them laugh when they least expect to laugh. And if even comedy becomes politically correct, which has been happening, then you know we're in a bad way. So I do think things are turning. I think if you add everything together, if you look at the millennial pushback that is happening against millennial fragility, if you look at the even these police forces saying, you know, let's stop investigating wolf whistles and get on with normal crime, if you look at Brexit, if you look at the populist uprisings that are taking place, not all of which are having positive consequences, but all of which are quite interesting and rebellious. And if you look at the kind of rise on campuses of liberal youthful groups saying, actually, we do want freedom of speech, I think there is a lot to be cheerful about. I think the task for people like us is to give a real sense of momentum to that pushback, and to really encourage it, and to talk to people about why it's so important to keep doing that, because those people will be under enormous pressure from the PC lobby to stop doing these things and to stop fighting for freedom of speech and to stop making offensive jokes. So the more that we can give them a sense of solidarity, then I think the better off we'll be in the long run in relation to defending freedom.
Excellent. Sorry, I know we've gone a little bit over time, but one final question.
Yes.
And we ask it to a lot of our guests. What's next for Brendan O'Neill?
We ask a lot of guests, what's next for Brendan O'Neill? Right, yeah. They've all got their own theories, so no one knows. Finally hear it from the horses.
No one knows, including me. What's next for Brendan O'Neill? Well, I am speaking at an IPA gala dinner, which I'm incredibly excited about, and I'm going to Sydney then to meet various people. And what's next between now and Christmas? I'm going to be pushing my book, Anti-Woke.
I meant like in the next, you know, next decade, say.
The next decade? Yeah, oh, my God. Do 5 people years. Think like that?
I don't know.
I don't think
the
like
next.
That.
That's a terrifying thought. Like a 5-year plan.
Yeah. I
am going to keep pushing Spite into new territory. That's the general gist, and particularly the United States. We've got a huge readership now in Britain and Europe and Australia. We're gaining a very strong readership in the US, and we want to push it further. So we're going to be doing lots of events in the US. We're going to be getting more US writers. So basically colonizing the world with Spike's pro-freedom message, that's what I'm going to be doing.
And you're sure that's not a 5-year plan, colonizing the world? Anyway, Brendan O'Neill, the book is Anti-Woke, available from Connoisseur Publishing. You can go online and order it now. Also the editor of Spiked, make sure you check it out. Brilliant, brilliant website. Brendan, thanks so much for coming back on.
Thanks, guys.
My name's Kyle Williams. I'm the campus coordinator for Murdoch University, and I'm really excited about Generation Liberty this year and being able to spread these incredibly important ideas on university campuses where most students won't be exposed to them without us. So make sure you get involved and come down, see what we're all about.
Okay, we now welcome to the show and welcome to the IPA, Dr. Zach Gorman. Zach, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
All right, so you are our newest IPA research fellow. Mm-hmm. Sorry, the title of newest research fellow has moved on from Kurt, now it's Zach. And you're also going to be working here on Western civilization and specifically a book on the Magna Carta. So do you want to talk a bit more about what you're planning to achieve with the IPA and maybe what this book is going to look like?
Yeah, it's just a great opportunity to be at the IPA. Obviously, there's not, as Bella will have been talking about in a lot of her articles recently, there's not a lot of places in Australia that are really pushing the history of Western civilization, these sort of more foundational, important things. But the IPA is somewhere that does give the necessary focus to the importance of Western civilization, the importance of basically our inheritance, our political inheritance, that begets all the freedoms that we enjoy in the liberal democracy of Australia.
Very cool.
So this book that you're writing on the Magna Carta, it's very interesting for me anyway to hear about the format of it. So you're looking at specific, tell me if I'm wrong here, which I often am, specific individuals for like 500 years before and then 500 years after or something like that, and their individual experience of the Magna Carta and how it impacted them. Is that right?
Yeah, definitely. So the Magna Carta, it's obviously a moment in time. It's Runnymede, it's 1215, it's the eve of King John, all the things that we associate with it. But it's also very much symbolic of a wider process of political development, of the development of political rights, of the development of restrictions on government and knowing where to draw the line between good government and bad government and tyranny and all these sorts of things. So the IPA produced a book on the Magna Carta a few years ago with Chris Berg and John Roskam. And that was a really good book that followed the more sort of traditional narrative of the Magna Carta, very much focused on King John and on oppressive taxation and how essentially the Magna Carta was a tax revolt that led to freedom, that necessity to avoid pernicious taxation, to avoid oppressive taxation was ultimately where liberty comes from. This book is going to take a wider view. Looking to the lead up, a lot of the focus will be on sort of Anglo-Saxon liberties, the Witan and various institutional developments that basically led up to Magna Carta. And then beyond that, how Magna Carta evolved over time through figures like Edward Coke and people like William Penn in America, who was the founder of the colony of Pennsylvania and the first person to print the Magna Carta in America and basically led to a lot of the political theory that went into the American Revolution and these sorts of things. So it's a very long-term story, ultimately.
Yeah, so when we talk about the Magna Carta, we're talking about like how barons just... as we said in John Ruskin's book, it's a tax revolt. The barons were trying to limit the power of the king. Do you want to expand, like, without giving too much of the book away, but do you want to expand a bit more on what people like Edward Curry started to expand the Magna Carta and how it... secured rights for ordinary people?
Yeah, essentially, Edward Coke is a figure in the early 17th century, in the reign of James I, and he's looking at Magna Carta as basically an old, a hallmark of an old lost English constitution that enshrined all the liberties of free Englishmen and free men. And this was, to a certain extent, a historical inaccuracy. He sort of imagined a mythical past that didn't really exist. But in the process of imagining this mythical past that didn't really exist, he elaborated on Magna Carta to be about more than just sort of specific limitations of taxation and various feudal duties, most of which had died out by the early 17th century, into being something that was a blueprint for the basic political rights of all free men. Things like the right to a fair trial, habeas corpus, not being arrested without being informed of why you were being arrested, all these sort of basic political liberties that we now hold dear.
All right, terrific. Now, of course, we know the Magna Carta has had a huge impact on Australia. You've written extensively about Australia's classical liberal history in the past and for the IPA. In the August edition of the IPA Review, you said Australia was the most liberal place in the world in the mid-19th century. How did that come about?
Basically, Australia was obviously founded as a convict colony, but as people got their freedom as far as coming out of the servitude of being a convict, they really embraced that freedom, and they really had an appreciation for political rights in a way that a lot of Europe at the time, and to a certain extent even America, who despite the Revolutionary War wasn't a full democracy at this particular time, they really appreciated their political rights. There were a lot of people who had been sent out to Australia as part of the Chartist movement and various other political agitations, fighting for political rights. So that political melting pot in Australia produced things like one of the earliest universal manhood suffrages, the innovation of the secret ballot, so being able to vote without other people knowing who you're voting for, so therefore you have a lot more freedom in who you are going to be able to vote for. And then ultimately leading to female suffrage and Australia, along with New Zealand, being basically the first democracies in the world to grant female suffrage.
Yeah, because one thing you say in your article is that a lot of people say that liberalism in Australia started with the foundation of the Liberal Party, and before then it was a bit of a weird concept. I should correct that, when the IPA formed the Liberal Party and has remained the puppet masters to this day. But you say, like, yeah, so 19th century Australia is an incredibly liberal place. Liberalism is just taken as every political leader believes in that. It's just a matter of fact. And then protectionism comes in, people that believe in protectionism comes in and tariffs, and that starts to go away.
Yeah, essentially. And even when there were threats to liberalism in the form of early protectionism, people wanted to couch it as liberalism. People like Alfred Deakin, David Syme, the editor at The Age. The Age has always been a pernicious influence on Australian politics. They, even though they were introducing new political ideas, greater intervention of the state, hopefully at the behest of economic interests and at the behest of the interests of the worker, they still wanted to claim ultimately that they were fulfilling liberal principles, because they didn't want to betray that title of liberal, because the title of liberal was so important in Australia, because conservatism, as it was defined in the 19th century, and conservatism in the 19th century is a very different thing to conservatism today, is very wrapped up in a landed aristocracy and an established Church of England that wasn't to be challenged and to have state backing and all these sorts of things. These things didn't really translate to Australia. So instead, people following English liberals like William Gladstone basically had a free playing field to do what they want in Australia, and they actually had a lot of success in that. Australia's economic growth throughout that 19th century is really remarkable, all on the back of sort of the enterprise of the people and basic economic freedoms.
So I get why Australia was more liberal than Great Britain, because of we didn't want aristocracy and things like that. But why? How are we more liberal than the states?
Well, the states still had their own particular political melting pot. So much of 19th century politics in the United States was obviously defined by the Civil War. It was defined by a sort of split between the anti-slavery Republicans and the pro-slavery Democrats. And the small classical liberal voice that there was in America. So, for example, Grover Cleveland, who's the only US president to have reduced the overall size of the federal government, that was very much a minority voice that was generally drowned out by the overarching political debates that were going on at the time.
Right. So this sort of brings us into your book. So you have a book out, Sir Joseph Carruthers, founder of the New South Wales Liberal Party, available now from Connor Publishing. Go out and buy that if you're interested in Australian history.
Christmas is coming up.
Christmas is coming up. But this is a guy who not a lot of people know about, I would say, but he should be a much bigger figure when we talk about the development of liberalism in Australia. So do you want to talk a little bit about what his deal is?
Yeah, so Carruthers was essentially the son of a convict from Kiama in New South Wales, a real sort of up-and-coming background as a child who was a bit of a sickly boy, and they sent him away with his brother to live in northern New South Wales, where an area that was so underdeveloped at the time that Carruthers was largely raised with the Aboriginal children and learnt to speak the Indigenous language and all these sorts of things. So he had very much almost a quintessential Australian upbringing, including both the sort of slavery aspect, the convict aspect, and also that sort of Aboriginality. But then he became involved in politics. He was a protege of Henry Parkes. He was very involved in the government of George Reid. He was involved in the Federation movement and all these sorts of things. But his overarching historical significance, certainly as far as I'm concerned and as far as my book is concerned, is that he started to view protectionism, the rise of the Labour Party and the socialist theories that were attached to that, as a real threat to the political freedoms Australia had, to the economic prosperity Australia had. And he really started to defend liberalism against these new threats. And in defending liberalism while simultaneously defending the status quo, that's where you get the emergence of this sort of centre-right liberalism that's pretty much unique to Australia, where the liberals are defending what already exists there. Everywhere else, particularly in Europe, in the UK, you're talking about conservatives defending overarching power structures that are basically medieval in origin, again, going back to that landowning aristocracy. But to be conservative, to defend what existed in Australia at the turn of the century, was ultimately to defend liberalism, to defend political and economic freedoms.
And that's sort of what you, like, in the end of your article, you say there's so much to be learned from Carruthers' experience in talking about free trade. And one of the things that he did successfully was come from a first principles perspective in defending free trade. And that was able to sell the working class on the idea of free trade, which other political leaders have struggled with. And so how was he able to do that?
Free trade with both Carruthers and his great friend and political ally, George Reid, was a policy that was incredibly popular with the working class in New South Wales. Working class electorates consistently voted free trade. Protectionist electorates tended to be some of the more rural electorates. But one of the main reasons he was able to be so successful in that is because he framed free trade in terms of everyone being a consumer. Everyone is buying sugar and tea and all these basic necessities that the protectionists wanted to put tariffs on. So if you're going to institute a protectionist tariff, even if you're claiming that it might save one or 2,000 jobs in a particular industry, all those jobs will be paid for by the sacrifices of every other Australian who is a consumer who has to pay more for every other good just to support that tiny fraction of the population that's going to be directly benefited by that protectionism. But yeah, essentially, so he turned liberalism into a centre-right movement, set up a Liberal Party in New South Wales to replace the Free Trade Party because free trade after Federation wasn't relevant to state politics. Tariffs had been given to the federal government. And he set out a sort of broad platform that was all about, it was about personal and economic freedom, about paying back a rather large government debt that was had been accrued by his predecessors, that was about reducing taxation, all these things that we come to associate with good liberal governments as opposed to bad liberal governments.
All right, cool. So that book is Sir Joseph Carruthers, founder of the New South Wales Liberal Party. Go to Conacore Publishing, the website. You can order it from there. All right, so you are from the University of Wollongong. Now, there is a freedom movement in the University of Wollongong that is going to take over the world. So we've got yourself, Renee Gorman, national manager of our campus coordinator program. We've also got our campus coordinator, Boston Edwards, who you'll be hearing from in the show.
Big Bad Boston.
Big Bad Boston, as Pete calls him, and I don't think anyone else would. But
they all do now.
But Boston Edwards, so three big fish coming out of the University of Wollongong. So is Wollongong the hotbed of the revolution?
Oh, definitely. Not that I'm too involved in student politics, obviously. When I was at Wollongong University, it was more as a teacher and also doing my PhD under a good friend of the IPA, Gregory Malouche. But this in student politics in UOW, there was a successful movement to extricate the UOW Student Union from the National Union of Students, which is obviously known for its corruption. There's still room for academic freedom at the University of Wollongong in a way that some of the inner city universities don't necessarily allow. The university does employ Gregory Malouche, who is just about the only right-wing historian who's a tenured professor left. And part of that is to do with it being a rural university, and a lot of its students are not just from the Wollongong area, but from places like Orange and Dubbo and out west in New South Wales, and they bring a lot of their sort of national party social conservatism with them.
All right, cool. Sorry, Dr. Zach Gorman, thank you so much for coming on the show. Can't wait to see the Magna Carta book and all the other stuff that you do here at the IPA.
Thank you.
Cool.
My name is Matthew Murphy. I study at the University of Sydney, and I'm studying a Bachelor of Psychology. The favourite thing for me about being a campus coordinator is that, well, there's this perception that people in unis are heavily left-wing, but when you do events, you come to find that it's actually not the case. And there is this big counterculture that turn up to these events and really get involved, and you really get to see that, you know, you have allies. You have a lot of people who want to get involved, who want to join things like Generation Liberty and IPA, and it's really encouraging, really rewarding, and yeah, I love it.
Okay, thank you to Brendan O'Neill and Zach Gorman for those interviews. Really interesting. Yes, we learned and we laughed. Now, if you want to watch the... Yes, absolutely. Now, the Brendan O'Neill interview will be on YouTube by the time this podcast goes out. So the whole thing in one session, recorded live at our podcast studio, that will be on our YouTube channel. So make sure you're looking out for that.
Unless you'd prefer not to know what we look like.
Which we would. So yeah. We'd understand.
Spoiler alert.
Almost support. But yeah, so let's get into some stories that have made us laugh this week, Pete. And I know you've seen a cool thing.
Yeah, so
Pete's Here's a Cool Thing segment.
This is one of our itinerant segments that come and go every now and then. It's Here's a Cool Thing when we see a positive story that we like and that makes us optimistic about the world, which all our work does, but sometimes there's a segment outside the IPA which makes us optimistic. The one today was, and this was shared by Tom G. Palmer, friend of the podcast, who's a global figure for freedom. And on December 5, which was Wednesday, this week was the anniversary of the end of alcohol prohibition in America. The 18th Article of Amendment to the Constitution of the United States is hereby appealed 5th of December 1933. Let's crack one open.
Crack one open, baby. Crack one open.
Here's to Nina. Nah, just kidding. We can't sing that on air.
Absolutely not.
But, yeah.
Yeah, it's a good thing.
Profies.
Big old step forward for liberty.
That's why, imagine during the Depression not being able to drink.
Yeah.
That's grim.
That's what caused it.
That's probably.
Yeah.
Like, how big's the booze industry? Pretty big.
Well, I think it still remained big. Like, the prohibition is always the number one thing of, you know, when the government says something is illegal, it doesn't end it.
No. It started the mafia, didn't it?
Well, I mean, it made a lot of people very, very wealthy.
Yeah. Jeez.
Yeah. Let's get into another one. So I want to start with this one. Okay. So George H.W. Bush died last week, I want to say. Last Friday. So he, 41st president of the United States, big figure. And among all of the photos and outpourings of grief, there was this one photo that went viral of his dog lying at the casket. Now, I'm an absolute soy boy when it comes to dogs. I will out loud say, hey, look, there's a dog, even if I'm standing by myself.
I'm an absolute soy boy.
So, like, that photo, that's catnip for me. I'm just like, look at that dog. It's like catnip.
What's catnip?
As in, like, I love that photo.
But what does catnip mean?
I have no idea, but I just know that it's
that's a thing. Okay,
a word for saying I like something. Anyway, I really like the photo. What do you want from me?
Yeah.
It's, you know, it's a loyal service dog.
Yeah.
The duty is done. That was basically the message of the dog.
Yeah, it was a sweet photo, sort of.
To most people, it was a sweet photo, except the good old people at Slate. So Slate is a pretty far-left magazine out in the United States.
So the photo went viral. Yeah.
And then Slate saw it, and they, you know, the author actually spent 800 words saying how much of a bad, like, how it shouldn't have been a viral photo.
Headline. She did a hit piece on a dog.
She wrote a hit piece on a dog. That's when you know you've made it in journalism.
Let's just think about that for a second.
Of all the things you can point at with George H.W. Bush, like, you know, you could talk about the Middle Eastern policies and stuff like that.
Raising
you
want to
go after the dog. Article, don't spend your emotional energy on Sully H.W. Bush, which is the dog. He's a service dog who had been with the president for 6 months, not his lifelong companion.
Yep.
So this is someone who's very fun at parties.
She's speaking truth to power.
Speaking truth to the powerful dog.
Yep.
Now, Pete, not entirely a dog person, I want to say.
No, I've got my own views on this, actually.
Yeah. Banana, you're a dog person?
I'm okay with dogs.
I'm huge on dogs. But anyway, okay. let me put the last paragraph to you. I'm going to read it out in full. The photograph, in other words, is not proof that Sully is a particularly good boy or that we don't deserve dogs, as countless swooning tweets put it on Monday. On its own, it says almost nothing other than the fact that Sully was at one point in the same room as a casket of his former boss. This is simply a photograph of a dog doing something dogs love to do, lie down. The frenzy around it captures something humans love to do too, project our own emotional needs onto animals.
Well, she's obviously hating dogs.
She hates dogs and people
and joy.
Joy and beauty. Everything and just everything.
Beauty and love and meaning.
Yeah, why? Like, go off. I love how she starts out going after a dog and then by the end of it, she's now going after me for projecting my needs onto a dog. I just like a photo of a dog.
To be honest,
oh, here we go.
A little bit of devil's advocate.
Watch where
because
you go with this.
I would never write that piece, but I'd sort of think it.
See,
I think we're a little bit mawkish as a society.
Things like that make me so disappointed in you.
That's what makes you disappointed.
As a human being,
we are over
your core.
Maybe not this in particular. But we are over sentimental as a society these days.
Yeah, but like, yeah, maybe yes, but also if you're not moved by that photo, then you are a troll figure. You are an actual made of stone.
I wasn't really. I mean, I was a little bit moved. Anyway, I wouldn't write the piece and it wouldn't be something I'd spend time on. The joke's on her, though, because she thinks she's slaying some sacred cow of the Conservatives.
Or dog,
as the case may be. But George, H.W. Bush
is
actually not that popular with Conservatives.
No.
Like, a lot of people think he was quite disappointing. Not that I'm putting my spin on it.
Yeah.
But that's what a lot of people think.
I think eventually you just have to, like, someone at Slate had to go, this ain't it.
Yeah.
Like,
nah.
800 words, like, you're taking out a whole day's worth of work to go after a dog.
Mm.
I mean, but the other part of it is, and I'll bring this up a bit later in the show, which is, got to get clicks. Like, I think Slate knew exactly what it was doing. It's like, this is going to get the internet talking, and boy, did it. Twitter went into meltdown on it, but this will get everyone talking. And then suddenly Slate's back in the news. So
maybe
mission accomplished.
Oh,
clickbait.
As Sully might have said.
Yep.
Or barked. Let's move on to another one, Pete.
Yeah, okay. Let's do... another animal one. Let's do another animal one.
Yes.
Peter. What's Peter stand for again?
I don't know what you stand for, Pete. Apart from your anti-dog message.
The animal people have said that we have...
People for the ethical treatment of animals.
Oh, very good. It's just a professional, isn't he?
Thank you.
are talking about that we shouldn't use animals or meat products in popular sayings.
Yeah.
So I'll give you an example. Don't say kill two birds with one stone. Say feed two birds with one scone, which only works if you pronounce scone incorrectly. Be the guinea pig. Say be the test tube instead of beat a dead horse. Isn't it? It's flog a dead horse. But anyway, say feed a fed horse.
Mm. Well, that's problematic as well, really.
Mm. Bring home the bacon. Bring home the bagels. Take the bull by the horns. Take the flower by the thorns.
So basically the idea that Peter was going for there, people for the ethical treatment of animals.
Yep.
I'm going to call you Gregory, which is your surname.
Yeah, just to just avoid.
Because this is going to get confusing.
Avoid confusion.
Anyway, so the thing that Peter was going for there is that there's certain sayings that we've put out of our talk, out of our conversation, because it's just not up to date with values. I think we all know exactly what I'm talking about there, but there's like certain words that are now pretty homophobic and stuff like that.
Yeah, absolutely.
And so they're saying, well, why don't we do this why are we just okay with these animal sayings?
Yeah.
And feed a fed horse, that's just as problematic. So now you're just encouraging animal abuse through causing obesity. So yeah. Peter really stuffed it there, up there. But then, this got the internet melting down. Everyone was making fun of it, but everyone's talking about how big Peter is.
Maybe we're part of the problem by continuing to put this stuff out.
Yeah, maybe that. Let's move on.
I like the tweet. Words matter, and our understanding of social justice evolves, our language evolves along with it. Oh, please, Peter, tell us how our understanding of social justice evolves.
Yeah,
that sounds like a riot. That
sounds like fun. Well, they did get a lot of cut through when they made that lunchbox move from circuses to the savannah.
Yeah.
So, you know, they just know how to get the internet talking about
it. And they sued that bloke for taking the photo of the gorilla.
Well, the gorilla took a photo of himself, but he used it for money.
That's right, because gorillas can't own intellectual property.
Yeah. Do you want to get? You guys want to look at that photo again?
We'll do
it after the show.
We'll do it after the show.
It's a funny photo. Okay, cool. I've got one here, so... a lot of animal themes. So last week was Britain themed. This week is animal themed. But anyway, Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer, holiday classic. It is coming up to Christmas season. So over in America, they played an animated movie of Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer, staying very true to the carol. And apparently it's problematic now. Mm. Again, this is one of those things where it's like, you know, it's very popular on the internet to hate things like a dog. And then people watch this movie and they start hating Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer. So I read out a few tweets here. Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer, teaching kids since 1964 that your peers will only accept your differences if you can provide them with some kind of service. Echoed by another one, watching Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer, the moral of the story I've learned since watching it as a kid, people are jerks until they need something from you.
What?
Everyone just needs to settle down a little.
What?
Everyone just needs to calm down.
I like it where they said Santa's reindeers need diversity training. Can you explain to me that? Because I'm actually not that familiar. What happens? Just give me a synopsis.
Okay, sorry. I'm not going to sing it. Anyway, so Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer.
Yeah.
He's got a very shiny nose. And if you'd ever saw him, you could even say close. Basically, he's outcasted from reindeer society because he's got a red nose and the others don't.
Yeah.
Until there's a really stormy night and Santa can't find a way to navigate it. And suddenly they find out that Rudolph's red nose can light the way and show them how to get to all the houses to drop off parents, presents. So instead of being the weirdo, he's now the savior.
Wasn't that a story about how we should accept people for their differences?
You'd think so, wouldn't
that's
you? That's actually why don't you embrace the stuff that's different about you and use it to help?
It doesn't show that we're all different and we all need each other?
Yes.
Well,
apparently it's problematic.
I'm
also, can I just say, like, to people that say, like, this just shows that people will be nicer to you if they need something from you. Yes.
Like, yes.
Yes, that's how the world works.
That's how society works.
If you are not able to provide anyone with anything, people won't like you.
Yeah.
If you can't give good conversation, people won't have conversations with you.
That's right. People stop being Grinch.
Yeah. Oh.
There you go. I say it.
Well, can't be Grinch anymore because remember they got banned from London. So they've taken away the Grinch. First they come for the Grinch.
Now
then they go for
Rudolph.
Next they come for Big Santa.
So do you like
worried about that?
You like this story, Nina? The reindeer.
Yeah, it's a nice story.
Yeah.
Itself. Like Rudolph being...
Oh, where does Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer, talking about Christmas songs again with Nina, where does that rank? Top 10?
Top 10. Top 10.
Big.
I'm a fan of Rudolph.
Yeah.
He's cute.
Big old red nose.
Well, there you go. Right. Well, that was HuffPost, wasn't it?
That was HuffPost.
Okay.
Okay, so we got one more, I want to say. We've got two more.
We've got Life is Pointless. So
yes. Oh, isn't it just? Anyway, sorry.
The Life is Pointless story. So Katie Tur, apologies if I pronounced that incorrectly. Probably haven't. Probably got it right. MSNBC anchor and author in America got on the telly during the week and said this.
I read that New Yorker article today and I thought, gosh, how pointless is my life and how pointless is are the decisions that I'm making on a day-to-day basis when we are not focused on climate change every day, when it's not leading every one of our newscasts.
I reckon our life might already be pointless.
Yeah, see, I'm willing to accept any and all people into the tribe of life is pointless, but I got to say, it's not because of climate change.
Yeah.
Like, the problems lie deeper.
Why am I doing anything? Why am I recording this podcast? Yeah, why am I wearing pants? If climate change is coming, what are we doing? Let's go party. Yeah. Enjoy while we can.
Sounds good to me. Crack one open. It's the end of, what is it? End of Prohibition.
Prohibition, yeah. 1933. Who said the left were nihilistic, eh?
Yeah. Who said the left weren't providing a positive message? Cool. All right. So last one I want to talk about here. So another protest, big protest theme, big protest and animal theme this week. In Sydney this week on Wednesday, it was this campaign called hashtag Walk Out Oz. It is protesting the gender pay gap. So we had, it's only like 100 women, but it did get into the news cycle. No, 100 women and men protesting the gender pay gap did get into the news cycle. People would leave at 3:50 to protest the fact that men are getting paid a bit later, like men are getting paid more. So
14%.
Women only have to work less. So they walked out the door at 3:50. So what are our thoughts on this?
Well, I'm surprised that anyone who thinks that gender pay gap exists is gainfully employed, but you know, wonders never cease.
You can get a whole lot of jobs in academia if you believe in the gender pay gap.
So that was interesting for me. What I did notice though, James, was that CNN, this got reported worldwide. CNN, as you know, are an American outfit, and they reported on this. They said a small poignant protest was held in Sydney, and what was interesting for me was held in Sydney on Wednesday, in which women and some men, so these blokes are like,
I very much care about
what you're doing, and so much so that I'm going to come with you.
Yeah.
That's crazy. So, you know, if that's the case, then why can't I also join in?
Should we join in a bit?
Well, men are overrepresented in podcasting, and as a man, yep. I reckon that's bloody wrong. You know, I've got solidarity with the sisterhood.
What's happening here?
And, No, I'm out. Stuff this.
Let's do this.
Me and Nina are going.
Bye, James.
No.
No, we've got nothing to lose but our chains, mate. See you later.
See ya.
Are you serious?
Yeah. Had enough, mate.
Right. Well, guess it's just you and me. All right. Well, that's it for the show this week. So thank you to Dr. Zach Gorman and Brendan O'Neill for those interviews. Once again, that's available on our YouTube channel. I don't know. What do we do? All right. So thank you guys so much for listening and subscribing. We're available on iTunes and Spotify, and anywhere that you can download podcasts, the IPA is going to be there. So make sure you're telling your friends and family about it once again, and make sure you're leaving us that 5-star review. Is coming into Christmas season, so leave us that 5-star review. It'd be really good. I should do the podcast just by myself the whole time. I'm really enjoying this. This is power. And if you, this is where I'd cross to Nina, but she's gone. If you guys want to join the IPA, and if people in your life want to join the IPA, make sure you're going to ipa.org.au. You can press the join buttons. You can press the donate buttons. You can give us some money coming into the Christmas season. Donate to our IPA Christmas appeal. That would be great. Cool. So I will see you guys next week with co-hosts, maybe? I don't know. All right. How do I turn this off? You know, I cherish you, my love.